U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken meets with President Xi Jinping in Beijing.
I reiterated our serious concern about the PRC providing components that are powering Russia's brutal war of aggression against Ukraine.
Plus, rabbis are protesting the Israeli government at the border with Gaza.
I'm really proud of it. Being here in the name of Jewish values, being here in the name of Jewish discourse and the Torah.
And later, former President Donald Trump asks for immunity, the head of Vietnam's parliament resigns, and we get the latest from Kyiv. Today is Friday, April 26th, and this is VOA's Flashpoint, Global Crises. Good evening, I'm Steve Karish in Washington. U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken met with Chinese President Xi Jinping in Beijing as he wrapped up his visit to China on Friday. During the meeting, Xi reiterated Beijing's concern that the United States is suppressing its economic development, adding that the world is big enough to accommodate both U.S. and Chinese development.
The two countries should be partners, not rivals. Mutually gain achievements, not hurt each other. Both countries should see common ground while preserving differences instead of vicious competition. Both sides should keep their word instead of saying one thing and doing another.
Blinken raised concerns about China's support for Russia's military, just one of the many issues threatening to sour the recent improvement in relations between the world's biggest economies.
I reiterated our serious concern about the PRC providing components that are powering Russia's brutal war of aggression against Ukraine. China's the top supplier of machine tools, microelectronics, nitrocellulose, which is critical to making munitions and rocket propellants, and other dual-use items that Moscow is using to ramp up its defense industrial base. A defense industrial base that is churning out rockets, drones, tanks, and other weapons that President Putin is using to invade a sovereign country, to demolish its power grid and other civilian infrastructure, to kill innocent children, women, and men.
The visit produced little progress on contentious issues, including U.S. complaints about cheap Chinese exports and tensions over Taiwan and the South China Sea.
In today's meetings, I discussed the PRC's dangerous actions in the South China Sea, including against routine Philippine maintenance operations and maritime operations near the Second Thomas Shoal. Freedom of navigation and commerce in these waterways is not only critical to the Philippines, but to the U.S. and to every other nation in the Indo-Pacific, and indeed around the world. That's why so many nations have expressed concern about the PRC's maritime maneuvers. I made clear that while the U.S. will continue to work to de-escalate tensions, our defense commitments to the Philippines remain ironclad.
Interestingly, following the meeting with Xi, Blinken went to a Beijing record store and purchased a copy of Taylor Swift's 2022 release, Midnights, on vinyl. Meet me at midnight. As anti-war and even anti-Israel protests are raging at colleges and universities across the U.S., anti-war activists, along with American and Israeli rabbis, demonstrated near the Erez Crossing in Israel to demand a ceasefire in Gaza. Avi Dabush is head of Rabbis for Human Rights.
I'm really proud of it. Being here in the name of Jewish values, being here in the name of Jewish discourse and the Torah, and talking about human rights for all people here. Of course, I can't forget the Israelis. I was in Kibbutz Nirim on October 7th and can't forget the hostages. But then again, I can't forget also our people, you know, human beings in Gaza that are starving, got killed by thousands, and have devastating ruins.
Demonstrators walked towards the border with Gaza with signs demanding peace and carried bags of food to symbolize aid being brought into Gaza. Police tried to disperse the demonstrators as they approached Erez, detaining at least five people. On Thursday, the U.S. Supreme Court took up Donald Trump's bid to avoid prosecution over his efforts to overturn his 2020 election loss to Joe Biden. Trump's lawyers argue that former presidents are entitled to absolute immunity for their official acts. Prosecutors say that giving a president absolute immunity could enable tyrants. My colleague Scott Walterman spoke about this with Richard O. Lempert. He's a distinguished university professor emeritus of law and sociology at the University of Michigan Law School.
So what were your overall impressions of the hearing today?
Well, there are two issues that I think are involved in terms of Trump's perspective. First, he would like a holding that he is absolutely immune from criminal trial for any actions that he took while president. He would probably like that to extend to even unofficial actions, but it seemed from the discussion with counsel today that he's really given up on that. But I don't think that was ever his real goal. The other goal seems to be to delay the trial until after the November elections. If he is then elected as a sitting president, he will be invulnerable for trial for the 4 years of his presidential term. And who knows what would happen at the end of 4 years.
So on the immunity question, it looks like a split, right?
I think it was clear from your argument that there would be no absolute blanket immunity, that immunity would certainly not extend to any actions that were taken in a private capacity, like running for re-election, as opposed to a public capacity, like using the executive powers as they're intended to be used.
Well, I think even his attorneys admitted that, right? I mean,
they did,
said,
right?
Yeah,
they were. Yeah, they said that. I think the real goal was to add to delay, and in that, it appears they did magnificently, and they almost certainly won because the Supreme Court seemed likely to remand the case to perhaps the circuit court, perhaps the trial court, to look at what he's being charged with, which constitutes an official action, and what he is being charged with, which is simply private personal action. If they do that, it is very hard to imagine a trial beginning anytime before the election.
Scott Walterman hosts International Edition here on VOA. He was speaking with Richard O. Lempert of the University of Michigan Law School. Over now to Ukraine, where the country marks the 38th anniversary of the Chernobyl catastrophe, while the Zaporizhia nuclear power plant, the biggest in Europe, remains under Russian control. Meanwhile, the Ramstein Contact Group on the Defense of Ukraine is taking place, aiming to deal with the air defense issue that Ukraine is currently struggling with. VOA correspondent Anna Chernikova has the latest for us from Kyiv.
On April 26, Ukraine marks the 38th anniversary of the Chernobyl catastrophe, which remains the largest nuclear disaster in history. Today, Ukraine is discussing the growing threat to the Zaporizhia nuclear power plant, which could become an even bigger disaster. Ukrainian authorities say that the occupation of the Zaporizhia nuclear power plant by Russian troops poses a threat not only to Ukraine, but also to the whole world. President Zelensky wrote in his Telegram channel that radiation does not recognize borders and does not distinguish national flags. He reminded that the Zaporizhia nuclear power plant, the largest in Europe, remained under Russian occupation for 785 days now, and that it is the duty of the whole world to put pressure on Russia so that the nuclear power plant is released and returned to the full control of Ukraine, and that all nuclear facilities in Ukraine are protected from Russian strikes. Only this will ensure that the world will not experience new radiation disasters, Zelensky concluded. Meanwhile, Russian forces continue to conduct missile and drone shelling across Ukraine. The areas affected the most in the past weeks are eastern, southern, and northern parts of the country. On the evening of April 25th, Russian forces hit the train station in the city of Balaklia in the Kharkiv region. 11 people were injured, According to the prosecutor's office, railway tracks were also damaged. British intelligence in its latest report has analyzed the situation in the Avdiivka area in the Donetsk region, concluding that the Russian advance in the area has accelerated over the past week despite heavy personnel losses. The department stated that the ground forces of the Russian army created a narrow passage deep into Ukrainian territory to enter the town of Ocheretine, located approximately 15 kilometers north of Avdiivka. They noted that since Russian troops took control of Avdiivka in mid-February 2024, the area remained one of the main targets of Russian operations. The Ukrainian military officials confirmed that the Avdiivka area remains the most difficult one and expect a possible stabilization of the situation after the arrival of the American aid that was approved this week. It is expected that this issue, as well as a number of other urgent problems, will be discussed at the meeting of the Contact Group on the Defense of Ukraine, Rammstein, which began in the afternoon of April 26. In his evening address on April 25, Zelensky noted,
"Готуємось до завтрашнього засідання Рамштайн. Будемо говорити,
we are preparing for tomorrow's Rammstein meeting and will discuss, among other things, how to overcome the difficulties and problems that have accumulated over the past 6 months while we have been waiting for decisions on American support. Politically, we have already achieved the support. Now we need to work on filling the packages with the necessary weapons and ensuring logistics. I am grateful to all the countries that have recently adopted new decisions on aid for Ukraine, our warriors, our cities, and communities. I am grateful to everyone who helps."
Дякую кожному, хто допомагає.
U.S. Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin said that the main priority of the meeting will be strengthening Ukrainian air defense. Austin noted that Russia has recently intensified its airstrikes on the territory of Ukraine. Anna Chernikova, VOA News, Kyiv.
And in a late-breaking development, U.S. officials tell VOA that Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin will announce a $6 billion military aid package for Ukraine on Friday. You're listening to Flashpoint Global Crises from the Voice of America. I'm Steve Karish in Washington. The head of Vietnam's parliament has resigned. We'll find out why and what it might mean in a moment. First, though, elsewhere in Southeast Asia, armed soldiers patrol the streets of Myanmar's frontier city of Myawadi near the Thai border as troops of the ruling junta and rebels jostle for control of the town that handles more than $1 billion in border trade every year. China, one of the junta's allies, has long been upset by Myanmar's inability to shut down online scam centers and other criminal enterprises along the border in eastern Shan State following a successful rebel offensive last year. Myanmar's home minister is now in Beijing for talks with Chinese officials on law enforcement and security cooperation, state media says. Earlier in April, Myawadi was the front line as resistance fighters led by the Karen National Union, one of Myanmar's oldest ethnic armies, pushed into the area and dislodged hundreds of the junta troops from their bases. But the Karen National Army, a militia force once entirely loyal to the junta, stood aside rather than fight fellow Karen people, leaving control of Myawadi up for grabs. And about 1,000 kilometers to the east, the head of Vietnam's parliament has resigned, making him the latest senior member of government to leave office amid an ongoing anti-corruption scandal. I speak with Lê Nguyen of VOA's Vietnamese service for the latest.
Yeah, Vương Đình Huệ, he's currently the chairman of the National Assembly. He's been serving since 2021. And as an NA chairman, he's one of the four top leaders of the country. And he resigned last night, Vietnam time. We don't know any specific wrongdoings that he committed. But according to the statement by the party, he resigned for assuming political responsibility for the wrongdoings of his existence.
So essentially he resigned because his subordinates were caught in a corruption scandal, and he's partly taking the fall for that, for making the party look bad, but it's not known if he was involved in the corruption.
The official statement issued by the party didn't specify any wrongdoings. And the statement also made clear that his wrongdoing, is negatively received by the public, and it damaged the reputation of the party, the state, and Hue himself.
So reputational damage, not so much criminal liability. Vietnam's also seen the resignation of two presidents in recent months. What's going on over there? Why such high turnover?
You know, it is unprecedented in the political history of Vietnam and in the history of the Vietnamese Communist Party. As you have noted, just last month, President Võ Văn Thưởng was ousted. And 1 year, more than a year ago, Thưởng's predecessor, President Nguyễn Xuân Phúc, was also removed, for assuming the responsibilities for the wrongdoings of his subordinates. So in just 2 years, we have seen three top leaders removed from their position. So what's going on here? I think, these leaders were burnt because of the very sweeping, very extensive anti-corruption campaign launched by party chief Nguyễn Phú Trọng. When he assumed office in 2011, Trọng launched the anti-corruption drive, which he promised will eradicate corruption from the party. And he promised there will be no exception and no official would be spared, no matter how high position he's holding.
Now, Vietnam as a country is growing fast. It's seen by many in the West as an alternative to China for manufacturing. Clearly, political scandals don't help. So how does the political situation in Hanoi affect the country's economy? How does it affect its future?
I think Vietnam is at a very critical point right now. As I just mentioned, the political upheaval at the very top of the party is unprecedented in the country's history. And, before this, the country had taken pride in political stability. If you look at Myanmar, if you look at the Philippines or Thailand, Vietnam has been an oasis of political stability. But, from now on, that should be in question, especially when the party is preparing for the next party congress in 2 years, in 2026, when the party will pick a new leader to replace party chief Nguyễn Phú Trọng, who's very infirm right now. So there's a lot of rumors that, there's a political struggle and political infighting within the party. So we can expect a lot of some instability in the future. And I think any foreign investors are thinking of relocating their production from China to Vietnam will take into account. And that's a really concern right now.
Le Nguyen reports for VOA's Vietnamese service. Mr. Nguyen, thanks for your time. Thanks for your reporting on this.
No problem. Nice to talk to you.
A popular Iranian dissident rapper has been handed the death penalty by Iran's Revolutionary Court. Tumash Salehi initially was arrested in October of 2022 and charged with spreading corruption on Earth, an offense punishable by death. Days earlier, he had posted videos on Instagram showing himself joining the Mahsa Amini protest movement and releasing a music video. از کف میایم به رأس هرم میزنیم شو میکنیم ببین چقدر دیدنی 44 سالتون سال شکست فجیع اون روز همه دارید دهن میپرید از کف میایم به رأس هرم. The Persian song, whose name translates to fortune telling, has the line 44 years of your government, it's the year of failure. Salehi initially was sentenced to 6 years in prison, but Iran's Supreme Court vacated that ruling and released him last November. He was rearrested 2 weeks later after posting another video online complaining of being tortured in custody. Here in Washington, Iranian-American comedian Max Amini ended a performance Thursday night by leading the audience in a chant for his release.
I'm in Washington, D.C., and the people of D.C. have a message for you.
Free to Iran! Free to Iran! Free to Iran!
Yvonne Rhee is a German parliament member who has long been an advocate for Salehi. My colleague Michael Lippin asked her on Thursday how he's been holding up.
I mean, his state of mind is pretty clear. He gave a statement himself just 2 days ago. So he tweeted, or he asked his admin to tweet for him, that he knew about, or he got his sentence, and he is very, very worried about his fans. So he is worrying about his supporters, his closed ones, even though he is the one sitting in prison and having been dealt with a death sentence. So he is always thinking about others first. So I think he hasn't lost any of his love or kindness towards other people. And what I heard is that just a few days ago, he was very, very loud about support for another prisoner, for another political prisoner in Iran. So he is the same Tumash as we have known and loved him. So I don't worry about what his mental state is concerned of. So I'm more concerned about his health, like his body.
Now, you've been trying to mobilize international support for Tumash Salehi for a long time now, including since his rearrest on November 30th last year. So what can you share about what you can do to mobilize that support to get this death sentence canceled?
You know, at first, when I became the political sponsor of Tumash Salehi, I always had to explain to people, to media, who Tumash Salehi was and how important, like, everything that is happening to him would be for everybody in Iran and how to read the sentences that he got. Right now, if you say, or if you write that Tumash Salehi got the death sentence, all media outlets all over the world know exactly what it means. So if you look at the outpour of outrage just yesterday, I mean, it was in the United States, there were so many media outlets writing about it. In Germany, there are so many interview requests. I don't even know how to do that anymore, because people know exactly how important Tumash Salehi is. And that's something that we build up for more than 1.5 years. And that's what impact Tumash Salehi has as a person. And I think it's really important for the regime to know that they can't do anything against him, because he has a status that they can't touch. I would warn them against doing anything against him, because they don't want to know what the outlet would be.
Well, as you've mentioned before, the Iranian government is aware of your activism, but it seems as if they've gone ahead and imposed a death sentence on him anyway, regardless of what you've been doing for all this time. So how does that make you feel?
So I think that everything happening to Tumash Salehi is pretty much a test to have a feeling about how people are still reacting to him, if anybody is still reacting to Tumash Salehi. And you have to know that the Islamic Republic of Iran is testing their waters just because what they did against Israel. So they want to know exactly how the international community is reacting. I think that's pretty much what they are doing with the death sentence against Tumash Salehi. And it's not as if they didn't leave any door open. As you said, the Supreme Court still has to decide. And I'm pretty much looking forward to see how that turns out, because nobody knows with the Islamic Republic of Iran. So I'm prepared for everything, but we will keep fighting and we will keep doing what we can for Tumash. So I don't think that there is anything that will stop us from our activism.
VOA's Michael Lippin speaking with German Member of Parliament Yvonne Rhee. And that's going to end today's show. There's more VOA coverage 24 hours a day on our website, voanews.com, and across our social media platforms. On behalf of everyone here at VOA, thanks for listening. Until next week, I'm Steve Karish.
For deeper dives and expert analysis, listen to VOA Podcasts. Issues in the News explores the biggest stories every weekend, while International Edition keeps you informed every weekday. Plus, with a 5-minute newscast at the top of every hour, you're always up to date.